WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 25th, 2018. Thanks for joining our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy as we whisk you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So go grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, the days are getting longer work-wise with all of the things that are going on in politics as we get closer to the March 20th primary, but at least I got to watch a little bit of hockey in the Olympic Games. Now, I didn't stay up for the Olympic athletes from Russia's overtime victory over Germany, but I did see the U.S. women's gold medal game, and I have to tell you, I mean, ending in a shootout at 1:05 a.m., okay? But what, it was great hockey.
You stayed up for the whole thing?
I did, yes.
Wow.
It was one of the best hockey games I'd ever seen.
Well, I saw the highlights, and it sure looked exciting.
That's why I had to stay
yeah.
up. That was a game you couldn't quit on. And the unfortunate thing, again, though, is you know what I think about shootouts. I hate shootouts.
You're not the only one. I've seen other people complain about these.
Well, but here's the gold medal game. And, you know, during the regular season in the NHL, you have your shootouts. But there's, you know, you could conceivably say there's another game, they're playing back-to-back games or something. You know, they've got to kind of wrap it up.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do it in the Stanley Cup. And
no.
And in the Olympic final game, it's not like they have another game to go to.
But they do play a full overtime.
They need to keep playing yeah. overtime.
So I think the argument is valid, but it kind of gets watered down just a little bit because they're not playing like a, you know, 3-on-3 overtime like the NHL does.
It was 4-on-4.
Yeah, it's 4-on-4,
but it's still
longer. It's a 20-minute period.
Well, so play it 5-on-5 and
yeah.
keep playing.
I agree. I mean, I've always likened it to the fact that
you can be a contrarian if you want. It's
well,
okay.
Well, let's, yeah, but I've agreed because it'd be like Major League Baseball going to the 12th inning, and it's still tied. Okay, time for home run derby,
right?
You know, or 3-point shooting contest in the NBA. You know, the NHL is the only league that I know of that changes its rules from the regular season to the postseason. Obviously, you keep playing until there's a winner. In the Stanley Cup, but you know, I was okay with the old way. You know, it's a tie. Okay, great, it's a tie in the regular season at least.
Yeah, and I'm still kind of torn about that. I mean, I would rather see the 3-on-3.
Well, it's exciting,
and it opens up some ice space. I mean, that was the hardest thing in watching the Olympic hockey is the bigger rink,
right?
And I mean, it's like you would see a puck kind of sitting there for like would seem like 5 seconds before somebody picked it up, you know. But it's designed to, you know, create more space, but at the same time, that space is a long way away from the net, and it takes more time for some of these plays to develop.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I'm not taking away anything from anybody on this. I mean, it was just fantastic.
That was good hockey.
I do miss the NHL not being in the Olympics, and I think that was reflected in some of the stories I saw about attendance, even though South Korea is not exactly a hotbed of hockey, but they were bemoaning the fact that the attendance at hockey was not good in these Olympics, but still some fantastic games. And I wouldn't have been able to watch the men's final anyway, but in checking some of my social media this morning, it looked like an interesting game.
Yeah, from all accounts, it was a rather interesting game. You know, and the Russian team, the Olympic athletes from Russia, they have a couple of former NHL players on their current squad. Pavel Datsyuk, and I think Kovalchuk's on there as well. Yeah, and the Americans had one that I know of. That was James Wisniewski. It looks like he played for the Blackhawks 30 years ago, and he's still skating with the American team. So I agree. it took a little bit of the interest away, I think, with the NHL players not being used in it. But yeah, there was still some good hockey played.
Well, and Germany being the big surprise, mm-hmm. and the poor Canada just trying to figure out what's going on here with us as a team in both the women and men's sport. But Datsyuk is one of the rare players to have won an Olympic gold, a world championship, and a Stanley Cup mm-hmm. ring. So, I mean, I bet the NHL will be back for the next Olympics.
It'd be nice. It would be nice to have that that happen again. That interest will be up for sure for pretty much everybody or any part of the world.
Well, I think really, if anything, the women's gold really will draw some attention to women's hockey, which it's great. I was at one of my local places during the week, and the women's team was playing, and I asked them to turn it on, and I think half the place didn't know that it was the women's team because of the helmets, and
yeah.
until they turned around and you saw maybe an occasional ponytail. Not that that necessarily means anything anymore, but they finally figured out that this was the women's team. They're going, hey, this is really good hockey. It was all good. But
and the ironic thing about the win for the women was that it came 38 years to the day that the yep. Miracle on Ice happened in Lake Placid.
Right. Which was not the gold medal game.
It was not the gold medal game. They beat Finland for the gold medal.
Right. But just have to give everybody those reminders. Yep. But what can I say about the Blackhawks?
I think you've just said enough.
Thank you. Man, I did not make it all the way
through. I did, unfortunately.
Third period.
Yeah, midway through.
And from all accounts, they dominated.
They did. They dominated. And hit a couple of posts. Bobrovsky was pretty good in certain situations, and again, the biggest story to me this whole year is the leads that have been blown, and also they had two leads yesterday, and I couldn't hold either, and it was a 2-1 game. Thomas Yurko scores. I mean, if Yurko and David Kampf are your goal scorers, you got to win the game.
Yeah.
You got to win the game. You know,
I mean, take the product.
Yeah,
man.
You have to win the game. So. Yeah, unfortunately, about 11 minutes into the third period, the Blue Jackets get the game winner, untying a 2-2 game, and then the Hawks again, they put on that fury at the end when they pull the goaltender, and just could not get one in.
Well, I did read in one of the newspaper stories that the Hawks do lead the league in one aspect.
Yeah, hitting posts.
54.
Yeah.
54 times they've hit the post this year.
Ridiculous.
Man.
Yeah, I mean, they say baseball is a game of inches. This is, you know, same situation. It's a 4x6 cage. And if you hit the 4 and you hit the 6, you're hitting the post.
And not to take anything away from Bobrovsky. I mean, he is one of the top goalies in the league, mm-hmm. and proves it every night when you're playing in Columbus, you know. And he gave up an early goal, and then it just kind of, you know, he got into his form. And I'm not so sure that the game winner for the Blue Jackets was necessarily your finest hour in net.
No, it was not. Anton Forsberg probably would want that one back 100 times and probably saves it 100 times if he does.
And that's been kind of a problem, mm-hmm. too. We obviously, with missing Corey Crawford, and I don't expect to see him for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I mean, they're 11 points out of the final playoff spot now, and time is winding down here in the regular season. So it's not looking good. I mean, obviously, you can't count them out until they're mathematically eliminated, but it's coming soon. Let's put it that way.
And if they only played in the Eastern Conference, they'd only be like 3 or 5 points out of a playoff spot.
Exactly.
That's what we get for being in the tough division,
right? Toughest division, toughest conference.
Yeah, I'm still rooting for him.
Oh, me too.
I'm still rooting for him. Maybe I put the Blackhawks hat away for a little bit. Maybe see if that'll bring a little magic back to the thing. Good to have baseball back. We've got baseball on today.
Mm-hmm.
White Sox Cactus League at 2:00. Great to. It's all kind of coming into sync. The temperatures are getting warmer. Baseball on the radio. Longer days. And then coming up ahead is that dreaded move the clocks up.
Oh, yeah.
It's 2 weeks away now.
2 weeks, yeah. two Sundays away.
Yes.
The worst day of my year.
Talking about the temperatures, though, you know, 40s today, Rick, but for tomorrow and Tuesday, into the 50s. And the rest of the week, though, there's some rain in the forecast, but all of the high temperatures are in the 40s.
Great.
For the day. So, yes, things are getting longer. We are slowly seeing the light.
That's good. And we're supposed to have a good sunny day today, too.
Yeah, as I said in the newscast, despite the cloudiness that we're seeing right now, I just checked the radar, and to the west, things look clearer. So I think we got a partly to mostly sunny day, at least, in store here.
Well, it might be time to fire up the grill later today. Maybe.
Get my golf clubs out.
Although the wind is still supposed to keep up. I mean, these 20-mile-an-hour wind gusts, or winds, sustained winds, really, are supposed to last all day.
It's tough to drive the newsroom Zamboni in that wind.
Yeah, I kind of afraid it when it tips over a little bit, right? There's nobody there to help set you back up, right?
I saw a great story about a woman who was chosen to drive the Zamboni, be on the crew for the Olympics over there.
Well, I understand there's like one of the largest teams at the Olympics is the Zamboni driver.
Yeah, but she made a very interesting point. You know, you would, because you follow hockey so closely, but every event that is played on ice has to have a different type of ice.
Right.
In other words, a harder ice for some of the skiers or skaters, you know, softer ice for other events. So you have to get it right. And if you don't, then they could blame you for losing.
Well, I can't recall ever hearing a Zamboni driver getting
blamed
for a loss.
That,
I don't know, Andy, you might have heard of some story.
No, well, but she good-naturedly said that, you know, if things aren't right, they do hear about it. So it's not just driving around and making sure the ice is there. There's more to it.
It's bigger ice.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, in the NHL with the smaller rink, if you're paid on the clock, you want to go do the Olympic games because the ice is bigger.
Maybe even some overtime.
Exactly, right. I need overtime. Yeah. It's a bigger rink. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy's here with the latest sports. Producer Casera is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. You can also communicate with us through Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is hiding the keys for the newsroom Zamboni as we speak. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Time for our weekly spin through national politics, and the discussion continues about possible changes in the nation's gun laws and debate about the NRA. Last week, President Trump held what he called a listening session that included parents from the Parkland, Florida school where 17 were killed on Valentine's Day. Andrew Pollack, the father of Meadow Pollack, was killed that day. Andrew Pollack said the focus should be on school safety.
Should have been one school shooting, and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed, because my daughter I'm not going to see again. She's not here. She's in North Lauderdale at whatever it is, King David Cemetery. That's where I go to see my kid now. And if it stops, we all work together and come up with the right idea, and it's school safety. It's not about gun laws right now. That's another fight, another battle. Let's fix the schools, and then you guys can battle it out whatever you want. But we need our children safe. Monday, tomorrow, whatever day it is, your kids are going to go to school. You think everyone's kids are safe?
That's Andrew Pollack, father of one of the victims of that school shooting. The president came up with some suggestions, banning bump stocks, raising the age to purchase firearm, hardening defenses around schools, and the potential of looking to arm teachers in the classroom. Here's what the president said at the conservative CPAC convention on Friday.
These teachers, and I've seen them at a lot of schools where they had problems,
These teachers love their students, and the students love their teachers in many cases. These teachers love their students, and these teachers are talented with weaponry and with guns. And that's, they feel safe. And I'd rather have somebody that loves their students and wants to protect their students than somebody standing outside that doesn't know anybody and doesn't know the students and frankly, for whatever reason, decided not to go in even though he heard lots of shots being fired inside.
Talented armed teachers. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We've been talking a little bit about the still continuing aftermath of the Parkland, Florida high school murders, and the students' response to that has been overwhelming, and it's a kind of amazing to see how it's put the NRA in this position of being flat-footed. So what does the NRA do? They're trotting out some of their spokespeople, and perhaps one of the most reprehensible things about this whole issue of gun violence was said by perhaps one of the most reprehensible people that I've ever heard. Her name is Dana Loesch. She's a conservative commentator and spokeswoman for the NRA who likes to be provocative because it gives her attention. She spoke to the CPAC convention, conservative conference, and so I'd like to give her some attention over these remarks.
Now I'm going to say something that some people are going to say is controversial. So I'll say it really slowly so all the people on the platform in the back can hear me loud and clear. Many in legacy media love mass shootings. You guys love it. Now, I'm not saying that you love the tragedy, but I am saying that you love the ratings. Crying white mothers are ratings gold.
Now, Dana Loesch claims to be a professional and knowledgeable, despite her offensive and inappropriate rant. But how professional is she? Well, here's the Dana Loesch that I hear on my early morning Sunday TV.
If you could be more heart healthy just by drinking a glass of earthy vegetable juice daily, would you do it? Probably not. But what if this performance-enhancing veggie was transformed into a great-tasting circulation superfood drink? It's called Super Beets, and I can help you try it risk-free.
That's right. She's also a beet powder supplement saleswoman, making health claims about a product that no scientific research has been conducted about. So yes, folks, please listen to Dana Loesch, because she's an expert. All right, we're going to switch gears here. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio this morning is State Senator Daniel Biss from Evanston. He's a Democratic candidate for governor. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me, though I'm not totally sure how to follow what just happened.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, it's horrifying. And I actually think your lead-in was ideal, that she's doing this to get attention, and maybe it's best for us not to give it to her. But it is pretty extraordinary that in the wake of the tragedy, those murders, and as we're watching so much powerful and inspiring and, I think, transformational activism, you also have some people who are just desperately using it to try to advance their own careers and elevate their own profiles. I think it's pretty sickening.
So what should we do about guns in schools?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The president talks about arming teachers, and I think we can easily dismiss that as a wacky idea. But even beyond that, you hear a lot of talk about more metal detectors and more security guards and
hardening the schools.
And to me, that idea is basically giving up. That idea is saying, hey, listen, we are stuck with school shootings as the new normal. It's time to accept it and do what we can to mitigate it. And I don't accept that fatalism. I think we cannot live in a world where it's supposed to be okay to just assume there's going to be a school shooting every 6 months or every year. Instead, we need to pass sensible gun safety legislation, of which there's some potential movement in Springfield even, but that itself would not alone be enough. And then, of course, we need to work much more comprehensively on funding of mental health services and universal access to mental health and counseling services across ages in and out of school.
I mean, one of the problems, obviously, is the flow of illegal guns from Indiana, namely, where the laws are less strict on who can get them. And that's beyond our control here.
That's right. I think the governor needs to do two things in addition to fight to pass strong laws in Illinois. One is to work with our federal delegation to change the landscape in Washington, D.C. We've got 18 members of the U.S. House and 2 members of the U.S. Senate. The governor should work closely with all 20 of those folks to begin to move Washington towards sane gun safety legislation. But the other thing the governor should do is work with governors of neighboring states. Illinois is, in many respects, the capital and should be the leader of the Midwest. And we should have a governor who sits down with governors of neighboring states and says, listen, I know that you may not be super excited about a particular gun safety measure, but we have to work together. We need give and take on a variety of issues. And in order for Illinois to have safe streets, in order for Illinois as a state to be able to cooperate with Indiana and Wisconsin on other economic issues, we need those states to cooperate with us on safety measures.
Some kind of leveraging?
That's right. Well, negotiating. Negotiating and understanding that Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana are part of a region and we thrive together or we suffer together. And we should be communicating strategically on a number of different issues. We should be engaging in give and take. And one thing that we should be doing as pushing other states is around gun safety measures, because you're right, that border between Indiana and Illinois is not impermeable, and if we do things that are only focused on addressing sales in Illinois, that alone will not solve the problem.
We talked about this kind of youth progressive movement that we're seeing kind of stirring up out of Parkland, Florida, and in many respects, those are the kind of movement kids and olders that you're trying to appeal to in this campaign.
Well, let's start by not talking about me at all. What those young people are doing in Florida and around the country is amazing. It's amazing to have the strength of character to turn this kind of nightmare into positive action and to do it with such toughness and strategic sense. I mean, they're running circles around the grown-ups. Let's just be clear about it. They're running circles around those of us who have been in this fight for a long time, and thank God for that. And so I don't want to compare my campaign to that in a crass way, but I do want to say that on all of the tough issues where we have not made the kind of progress that the people of our country and the people of our state deserve, the solution's going to come from activism. The solution's going to come from movement behavior. The solution's going to come from ordinary people rising up, saying we're not going to accept what we've had before and we're going to build a new politics, a new community, a new society to fix it. And that is what our campaign has been about. It's been about people coming together to reject a broken old politics, build a new kind of campaign so we can change what's possible and build a new state of Illinois.
I'm curious about the state of the Democratic Party as it exists today.
And
of
you course, and me both, my friend.
Well,
and me both.
And I know you make that as part of your stump speech about this race being about the future of the Democratic, the soul of the Democratic Party. But, I mean, we're seeing things here. Last night in California, the California Democratic Party did not endorse Dianne Feinstein for reelection as part of kind of a progressive movement there. And I'm wondering, are we at that point now where the Democratic Party as we know it is we don't know?
Well, on a national level, the Democratic Party came out of the 2016 election after pretty rotten 2014s and 2010s, kind of at what I hope is rock bottom, just in terms of numbers, in terms of number of Democrats in the House and the Senate, number of Democratic governors, number of Democratic majority state legislatures across the country. We were in a really rough spot. When you're in that spot, it's time to make big decisions about the future. It's time to pick a direction. It's time to pick a new direction one that's more in line with what the people need. And here in Illinois, where Bruce Rauner's taken the state of Illinois apart for the last 3 years, the truth is that for the previous 30 years, things weren't so hot either. And for the 12 years before Bruce Rauner became governor, Democrats were in unified control of state government, and there was plenty that didn't get done then either. And so I think this is a moment for us to decide who we're going to be as Democrats. And right now in Illinois, when we've got Bruce Rauner, an inexperienced failed billionaire, as our governor, and Donald Trump, an inexperienced failed billionaire, as our president, Democrats get to decide, do we want to just say, okay, we're going to do what they've done that hasn't worked? Are we going to say, if you can't beat them, join them and pick our own inexperienced billionaire? Or will we instead pick a middle-class progressive who believes in movement politics and making fundamental change?
When Democrats had unified control of the state, why didn't more things get done?
I think we have a system in Illinois where the wealthy and connected have way too much power. We have a system in Illinois where things don't change very much very fast because there's a collection of people who benefit from things the way they are, even though most of us don't. And I think that that system has infected both parties in the state of Illinois. And it's time for us to remake the Democratic Party based upon a hunger of grassroots activists across Illinois for real progressive change.
We're speaking with Democratic State Senator Daniel Biss from Evanston. He is a Democratic candidate for governor. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined by Democratic candidate for governor and state senator from Evanston, Daniel Biss, here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Senator, give me your assessment right now as we start rolling into the March real going for it, March 20th. How do you assess where things are in this race?
Well, so there's 23 days left. We're really coming into the home stretch, and I feel incredibly excited about the momentum that we've built. It's not just that we're surging in the polls, though that's been wonderful to see, but it's the unbelievable growth in volunteer hours and small donors and activism across the state. It's these amazing endorsements from groups like Move On and Reclaim Chicago and the National Nurses United, Sierra Club, Our Revolution. We feel like things are moving really fast for us. My sense is there's still a lot of undecided voters, and I think what that means is they've seen that one of the options being presented to them is an inexperienced billionaire, and they're looking elsewhere, and with the kind of energy that we have right now in our campaign, they're moving our way. I'll tell you one quick story. Yesterday, my incredible running mate, Letisa Wallace, was doing a little coffee, a session with a couple dozen voters in someone's living room, and as she's there giving her speech, the doorbell rings. And one of our volunteers says, hey, I'm a volunteer for the Biss Wallace ticket. Who are you guys for? And, you know, I think they'd been pretty well convinced by then. But we just have an incredible and passionate crew of volunteers across the state. And I think that's what's going to put us over the top.
There's been a lot of discussion in this campaign about the issue of our pension debt and pension funding. And you were a sponsor of a bill that was later ruled unconstitutional in an effort to try to alleviate some of these pension issues. And you've said it was a learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you're getting attacked for having sponsored that. What's your response?
Well, let me start by just talking about my own position. I got to the legislature in 2011. It was a time of a tremendous financial crisis in the country, in the world, and tremendous debt here in Illinois. And I was trying to struggle with the best way to address that, and eventually got sucked into a false choice that said that, hey, listen, Daniel, people said, you may want a progressive income tax, and you may want to tax the rich to fund these pension systems, but that's not going to be possible until we either make changes to pension benefits or else make cuts to social services and education. And I accepted that false choice too quickly and picked what I thought was the least bad of the bad options and moved forward. And the Supreme Court overturned that bill, and they were right to do it. We shouldn't just accept a false choice like that. If the right thing, as I believed then and believe now, is to tax the wealthy and fund our pension systems, then we should have been fighting to change what was politically possible, not just accepting what was politically possible at the time. And that's been a really important learning experience for me. And if you look at my voting record since then, it's been about trying to do what's right even when it's difficult. and sometimes taking lonely positions, knowing that if I stake out the right but lonely position, other people will eventually come to me. And I think we need a governor who's not going to accept when the people who are currently benefiting from a broken system say, hey, you may think that one thing is the right thing to do, but the votes aren't there, so you might as well do something else instead. That's my position. And I, like I said, I think we need a governor who's learned that lesson. What I find frustrating about the attacks is that they're coming from J.B. Pritzker, who is approaching this issue with the most overwhelming level of hypocrisy imaginable. Back at that time, when I was in the legislature doing my best to tackle these problems, he was doing just one thing. Just one thing. He was funding an organization that was trying to push for pension changes. He was funding an organization that was well to my right. He was funding an organization that was pushing to eliminate pensions altogether. He was funding an organization that was attacking me for not going far enough on pension changes. And so while I say, listen, I was in there trying to address this. I'll acknowledge I wasn't addressing it the right way. I'll tell you what I've learned from it and how I'm going to address it going forward. He refuses to accept responsibility for what he did. He ducks the question. He dodges the question. He doesn't say he's learned anything. He just tries to change the subject. And that difference between how I address this and how he addresses it, I think speaks to a fundamental difference in leadership style and, frankly, a difference in character.
Well, we still have this overhanging pension debt. What do we do?
Three things. Number one, we need to make sure that we always make actuarially responsible payments into the pension systems. Not sometimes, not when it's politically convenient, not when we're in a growing economy, but every single year, no matter what. That's number one. Number two, we need to make the changes to our tax system to make that affordable by taxing the rich, by changing the Constitution to allow for a progressive income tax, by taxing financial transactions at the Board of Trade, by closing the corrupt Bruce Rauner carried interest tax loophole that allows hedge fund and private equity fund managers to reclassify their income as though it were not income, and in so doing get almost a 20% tax cut. And then number three, we have to find constitutional fair ways to decrease the cost. For example, Illinois has 628 different pension systems, more than any state but one. If we were to consolidate many of those, we wouldn't touch anyone's benefit. We wouldn't be doing anything that anyone could characterize as unfair or unconstitutional. All we would be doing is making it hard for politically connected consultants and vendors to reach their hands into all these different pots of money and pull some out for themselves, and we'd also be saving money. So if we take these steps, make sure we make the payments every year, make the tax changes necessary to give a fair tax system that would make it affordable, and then find constitutional fair ways to decrease cost without harming workers, we will get through this.
I know the talk of doing a graduated income tax is pretty common among all of your candidates here in this contest. But we've seen in the past how difficult it is to try to advance that as a constitutional amendment. And even if it were to get on the ballot, it's pretty obvious what the opposition is going to be, because it's not going to have tax rates in it. And you could commit to whatever tax rate you know, whatever, but it's going to be a scare factor game about they're not going to tell you how high they're going to raise the tax on you. Well, can you trust them?
Well, I'll address that in a minute, but I first want to say that you're right. Experience has shown that it's hard to get that fair tax referendum on the ballot, and that's why it's so important that I be the nominee. You're right. All of a sudden in this campaign, all the candidates are saying they support a progressive income tax, and I'm glad they've come along to agree with my position, but that's something I've been fighting for since I first started running for state representative a decade ago in an affluent district, by the way. I used to knock on doors in Winnetka and tell people, hey, listen, we need a fair income tax that asks the wealthy to pay their share so we can stop overtaxing the middle class and the working poor. I have been working to build the coalitions needed to get that done. I know it's the top priority because that flat tax provision in the Constitution is the original sin in Illinois budgeting, and I'll be working on that as job number one. By contrast, these other guys now all of a sudden have figured out that's in their political interest in this primary to say they're for it, but where were they when we were fighting to get it done in 2013 and 2014? J.B. Pritzker has spent $56 million of his own money on this campaign. Let me tell you, if he'd been willing to spend $56 million helping us pass a fair tax amendment in 2013, we wouldn't have this problem anymore. So listen, if we want someone who actually can be trusted to get it done, I am your guy. But to your question, you're right. I don't think we should just put an abstract theoretical referendum on the ballot. I think we ought to give people a real choice. I think we ought to pass a law that says, here's what the tax rate should be if the Constitution were to be changed. Here's what the budget would look like if the Constitution were to be changed. Here's how our property tax system would get fixed if the Constitution were to be changed. And then when folks go to the polling place to vote on the referendum, they're not voting on a theory. They're saying, if we vote yes, we get this particular tax code and budget and government system. And if we vote no, we have to stick with the status quo. And I think in that environment, people will be eager to vote yes.
So pass a tax code that's conditional upon passage of a constitutional amendment.
Exactly right. And then you can have calculator apps online that will show people, hey, if I make this, here's what the change would be for me. And instead of then allowing scaremongers to say this is going to be a tax increase on the middle class, people will know, based on what's already in the law, no, wait, this is going to be good for the middle class, good for the working poor, because we'll finally be asking the wealthy to pay their share.
But you're still not at a point about where those rates might be.
You know, that's got to get worked out together with the other side of the ledger. I think it would be irresponsible to say, here's a specific tax code, a particular rate at a particular number, without then explaining in every detail what's on both sides of the ledger. You've got to work out a budget comprehensively so it's balanced, so it's sustainable, and all the different parties have to be at the table to make sure we get it right.
Senator Bist, people want to find out more about the campaign.
DanielBist.com, or you can visit us on Facebook at Facebook.com/DanielBist or Twitter.com/DanielBist. We've got 23 days left in this fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. 23 days left to pick a middle-class progressive over an inexperienced billionaire. Join us in this effort to create an earthquake that will fix the Democratic Party.
Is that 12-hour Facebook Live posted in entirety on that Facebook page?
It's in several blocks, so you can, you know, just 3 hours at a time, Rick.
Just for those, you know, grab your popcorn and dial it up, right?
I cannot imagine a more interesting way to spend your Sunday.
That's Democratic State Senator Daniel Bist from Evanston, candidate for governor. Senator, thank you as always. Appreciate it very much.
It's great being here. Thank you, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me now in studio is Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So I want to talk to you about, we're a week later from the governor's budget message.
Yeah.
And Republicans are saying it's a balanced budget that he's proposed. I would say there's a framework of a budget. I wouldn't say that it's balanced, but at least there's a framework that was lacking in his previous forays into budget making. How do you assess the document that he presented?
I think you described it pretty well. I will say that it's not even close, though, to being balanced. It's closer than his prior budgets, which were on the low end $3.5 billion out of balance, and on the high end around $7 billion out of balance. But the number that's been quoted of it being about $1.5 billion out of balance, is that number's not even correct. I mean, because if you just look at the numbers that we've now received that are accurate financials as a result of the Debt Transparency Act that you and I have spoken about on prior interviews here, we now get monthly reporting from the state agencies. So these aren't numbers that I'm making up. They're numbers that are coming directly from his own state agencies. And they identified in the latest report, which came out the day before the budget address, and the numbers weren't much different from the one that came out the month before. We submitted that report to the governor, asked him to incorporate these financials into his budget address, right, so that he could, in fact, present a balanced budget proposal. And none of those numbers, I think, were taken into account. I mean, we asked for five specific things to be addressed. For example, how would he pay for the $2.3 billion in deficit spending that occurred last year? That number was not addressed in his budget address. We still have about an $8.5 billion bill backlog. So that's not imaginary. You have to address that, at least a plan for paying it down. And that really wasn't addressed in that budget address. He just said we should pay down the bill backlog, but there were zero specifics associated to how we would go about paying that down. And I would consider that a necessary thing to tackle when looking at balancing a budget. There were also the issue of about $1.2 billion in pending liabilities. Those are bills that we're not even talking about, but they're very real bills. Those are services that have already been rendered or will soon be rendered that we know are coming in this cycle, but the invoices have not been submitted to the state of Illinois yet. So, and that means not just to me, but also to the agency level. But the agencies know that at some point in the near future, they'll be getting these invoices. So we have to count those towards expenditures, right? $1.2 billion there. And then also, how are we going to pay for the $1 billion in late payment interest penalties? How are we budgeting for that? So if you add up the numbers, it's really kind of horrifying, and it goes well beyond $1.5 billion, which is being touted. They're saying that they only have a $1.5 billion bill, I should say deficit spending line, but their own numbers are telling us that at the very least it's $2.3 billion. So again, you know, I've used this reference that it's, you know, a combination of magic beans and pixie dust, and I'd add vibranium because I've seen Black Panther and that's just too cool. I can't not say vibranium moving forward. But in any event, it's not a real budget.
To Wakanda, is that maybe that'll
Wakanda forever? Yes, no, it's not a real budget. Unfortunately, you know, I don't think any of us are surprised. And let's just hope that the legislature can figure out a way to get to a balanced budget proposal, because our state just cannot afford another year. 2 years, just another cycle, period, of going without a budget. It's just really, it's unconscionable.
I have to say, personally, I'm not optimistic that we're going to have a budget, given the election year antics that are already playing out. And I could see perhaps the potential of a six-month budget to get us up to whoever becomes governor, or if Governor Rauner remains governor. Perhaps I could see that. But I think there's just too much polarization and too much at stake for the legislature to approve a budget.
Well, I want to be more optimistic, because I was optimistic on July 6th when I saw both Democrats and Republicans, rank and file members, right? I mean, basically the leaders just got out of their way. And rank and file members of both parties come together and do what was right for the state of Illinois and pass a budget and end the impasse. Yeah, it's an election year, but I think no one wants to go through that again. Like, I'd still like to believe in my heart that legislators choose to serve because they want to make things better. And I think this was an experience that no one wants to have to go through again. So I want to believe in people's better angels here. And trust me, I'll be very vocal if I see that those angels turn more into, like, devils, right? But at the end of the day, I'd like to believe that we can do this, and that I'm going to be providing accurate financial figures to the legislature, something that they've never had before, right? So, again, I can't underscore this more importantly. Working in the month of March, April, and May, when it's critical time to come together to craft a budget with real financial figures, accurate data, is something that no legislature has had for year after year after year after year. So there really is no excuse to not really work towards getting to a balanced budget proposal. Kicking the can down the road, Brian, you know, talked about this a little bit earlier in the interview, and I think nailed it. The prior governor attempted to do that. The prior legislature decided to kick the can down the road and let the governor decide on this expiring, right? And look what happened. As a result of kicking the can down the road, we went into, I would say, this laid the foundation for a 1 to 2 year budget impasse. We need to learn from these mistakes and do better, and hopefully these guys will do that, men and women.
Are current revenues enough for expenditures?
No, even the last budget that passed, I would say, as a comptroller, now looking at all these figures, is out of balance. I mean, it's $2.3 billion in deficit spending that we now know of as a result of the Debt Transparency Act, $1 billion in late payment interest penalties that we've accrued, yet have not identified a way to pay for them. right? No, we still owe $8.5 billion, which is a lot of money, but it could have been worse. I mean, it was worse in July. We owed up to $16.7 billion. And I think maybe the last time I was on your show, I was advocating for a bonding deal that the governor was fighting me on. And thanks to that bonding deal, we were able to refinance about $6 billion worth of that $16.7 that we were paying 12% interest on at an amazing 3.5% interest rate. So that saved taxpayers between $6 and $8 billion, and has now brought our bill backlog down to about $8.5 billion as of today. So we're on our way. I do see light at the end of the tunnel, but we can't continue to double down on the mistakes that got us to that $16.7 billion bill backlog. And I don't think any legislator of either party enjoyed being a legislator under those circumstances. So, you know, again, I'm gonna ask the legislature to, if they feel that the governor is once again just going to be playing games with the situation, to do the right thing for the people that they're elected to represent, to come together, both parties, and figure it out, because we can't go into another year without a budget. It's that simple.
We're speaking with Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Joining me here in the Showcase studio is Susana Mendoza, Democratic Comptroller for the state of Illinois. We're talking about what to look for, look ahead when it comes to the state budget. And we're talking about the Debt Transparency Act, which was something that you pushed for to finally provide some accurate numbers, because up until then, it was kind of a guessing game of what potential liabilities are, what are the agencies actually holding for bills that they haven't submitted for payment, which was all part of this kind of crazy structure of our budget problems.
Yeah, it's like a guessing game. I mean, can you imagine, as a state's chief fiscal officer, in my first week on the job, I realized that I did not have full visibility of the state's liabilities. I mean, I think if there's one person in the entire state that should have full visibility of the state's liabilities, it would be the person responsible for managing the state's accounts. Yet, the opposite is true. So this is when we decided to, rather than get what by state law was a once-a-year report of the state's total liabilities, and all it told me is the total liabilities, no other information. It said you owe X, the state agencies are holding on to X dollars. And I would get that report in October, and it was only current as of June 30th, which is already, by the time I get it, 90 days late or older. Out of date, I should say. And by that point, you start, again, accruing late payment interest penalties, because in Illinois, after 90 days, if you're late on your bills, you start to accrue these penalties. So the legislature, who is then, you know, convening, like I mentioned earlier, let's say in the month of May is the critical point where they have to come up with a budget, a balanced budget proposal, and actually pass it. They're working off of financial figures from June 30th of the prior year, right? It's kind of like asking people at home who manage their checkbook that they only get to look at their checkbook, not even balance it, just look at it once a year and 3 months after the year has already closed out. So it's, you know, just ridiculous, really. And so that's no way for any controller to be able to do their job managing the finances and providing, you know, a good comprehensive plan for cash management or debt management. And we sought out to change that. In May, I passed a bill with an almost veto-proof majority. The governor, unfortunately, vetoed that bill in August, you know, which this is the largest transparency reform to ever hit the Office of Comptroller, and I'd argue one of the largest to hit the state, period. And the governor vetoed that bill in August. But thankfully, the legislature came together, and, you know, I spoke with almost every single representative in both parties, and we got a unanimous, this has never happened before in the history of the state of Illinois, in the House of Representatives, a unanimous override of the governor's veto, and in the Senate, almost unanimous, with only three Republicans sticking with the governor against transparency. So this was an overwhelming rebuke against hiding the numbers, right? Basically hiding the ball. And it's not just from me, but I would argue to the taxpayers, right? So we are now, as a result of the Debt Transparency Act, which requires monthly reporting to my office, doing these monthly reports. We get the numbers, and within a few days, we put together a very easy-to-follow summary in a report and make those numbers available not just to the press, to myself and my staff, but most importantly to the taxpayers via our website. It's the first thing you see when you go to our website, illinoiscomptroller.gov.
There's your plug. Okay. I want to switch gears in the couple of minutes we have left. You were named by Speaker Madigan, along with Congresswoman Sherry Bustos and Representative Carol Ammons, to this kind of, I don't know if task force is the right word, but it's up to you three to kind of chart the role of women and protections for women in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I mean, obviously, I take a lot of pride and honor to be able to be one of the three people, specifically on this panel, who's charged with leading on this issue and coming up with, you know, what can we do to eradicate this pervasive culture of sexual harassment, which doesn't just exist in politics. I mean, we see this in the public and the private sector. But certainly when it comes to our party, we can and we must do better. We also want to talk about what do we do as a party to elevate women into greater positions of leadership within our party structure, right? So if you'll entertain me for 1 second, I'll share with you what our mission statement is, which we have not actually shared with anyone yet. But we just had our very first working panel. We're calling ourselves this panel. And our mission statement is that the mission of the panel is to engage our primary stakeholder, women in democratic politics, to identify and help eliminate obstacles, including sexual harassment, and to elevate women into positions of leadership in the Democratic Party of Illinois by providing recommendations to promote a culture of equity, safety, and respect. So we are very, very focused on trying to clean up this culture, right? Just a whole brand new culture that would provide for safety, equity, and respect. And then also at the same time tackle this issue of what can we do to make sure that more women feel that they have the ability to rise within the party, whether it's in the campaign level, right, with positions of leadership within campaigns, or women who want to run for office, right? Like, we have monumentally more obstacles in our path than your average man does. And if you're a woman of color, you can multiply that exponentially as well, right? So our party is looking to lead in this respect, and we have to learn from the mistakes of the past and just do things better.
Do you think Speaker Madigan ought to step down as party chairman?
Well, number one, let's just acknowledge that this is an issue that goes well beyond the chairman.
Understood.
I think that our panel, first of all, is focused on not playing the politics of this, but actually doing the work of fixing the problem. And this is such a problem that is so much bigger than any one person or any one party. And I think for us to weigh in on that politics, which, by the way, prior to joining the panel, I was critical of how this was handled. I think 3 months was too long. You know, I joined early on in the voice that said that they should do an investigation and look into further what happened, and could we have done a better job, which I think is without a question, yes. The answer to that is yes. So 3 months is too long. I think that the chairman has to and will do better. He has to do better. And I think that our panel, though, has to focus on the work of the panel, which is so important to get into the politics and the fray. To get into the fray instead of being above the fray is really to just diminish the severity of this issue of sexual harassment. And so we're very focused on that. We don't want to weigh into the politics of this or that. It's not about one person. It's not even about one party. But in this case, these three women, and Sherry Bustos is amazing, Carol Ammons is amazing, and I would say that they are fiercely independent. We are going to focus on this huge task. And, you know, I could joke around and say that, you know, the men have to do what the men have to do, but the women must fix what they couldn't. So we're going to take care of this.
That's Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Thank you so much for joining me, as always.
Thank you for having me. Anytime. Let's do it again.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower on a sunny North Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in studio is Marie Newman. She's a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. That's the southwest side and southwest suburbs. And she is the challenger in the seat that is currently held by Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski. Ms. Newman, thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning, and thank you for having me here.
I spoke with Dan Yobis, the Democratic candidate for governor, about this, about the Democratic Party kind of being at, I think, a tipping point in some respects. And in some respects, I see your candidacy, obviously never easy going after an incumbent.
Right.
But your candidacy kind of emblematic of that. Tell me about why you decided to get in. Where's your support coming from?
So the easiest way to describe this is that I got in because of need and want. So I looked at the district and realized how unhappy the residents of the district were. I've been watching Lipinski's votes for the entire time he's been in Congress, which is 14 years, and he always votes against the district, whether it is against immigration rights, against DACA, against working families, against expanding the middle class, and saying that he's working on infrastructure and absolutely no evidence that he is, and on and on and on. And he's on an absolute mission to take away women's rights of all sorts. And LGBTQ rights. So with that, as I watched that unfold and talked around the district frequently, it's what's happening in the Democratic Party. We're speaking up. We're saying we're not going to put up with this anymore. This guy who is should be in the Republican Party needs to go to the Republican Party, and we need to have a progressive voice in place that will fight for working families and expand the middle class and get us health care for all and protect everybody's rights.
Has the district changed? I mean, you know, the yeah. Lipinski name has been in that district. His, Dan's father was obviously there a long time. But it was, I mean, in some respects, it was a socially conservative district.
You know, I think that's right 20 years ago. And with all due respect, it changed about right around 14, 16 years ago. It started to change dramatically. So we are a district that was taken by 8 points by Bernie in the primary, solidly progressive, and Hillary took it by 15 in the general. So that tells us it's true blue Democratic, no two ways about it. 33% union households, that's gone up about 6 or 7% in the last decade. It's 30% Latino Americans, about 9.5% Arab and Muslim Americans, and then the rest of it is this gorgeous mosaic of everything, right? So it has gotten slightly younger in demographic, too. So all of that combined has changed the district dramatically, certainly in the last 14 years, but probably started to change before that. So it might even have a few conservative pockets left. And I think that we're all smart voters in the 3rd District, and it's not just about one issue. It's not just about rights or one thing. It's about that we have a congressman who has done literally nothing. Literally. He has gotten one bill passed out of committee to name a post office.
How much of this is also a challenge to Democratic establishment?
Dramatically, I would say. So between Bill Lipinski and Dan Lipinski, we have had 36 years of the Lipinski monarchy. By the way, everyone in the district calls it that. And then the Chicago machine has supported the monarchy. And everyone is completely fed up with it. So it's time and place, right, is that it's the right time to get this done. And now we have an opportunity because we are so in alignment. I've had 135 meet and greets throughout the district in the last 13 months, met with 5,000 people. We have a strong media program. We have strong following. And I have over 1,000 volunteers. So this is the right time to break up the machine on the southwest side and get it done. If we can take Lipinski out, then that helps break up that machine quite a bit.
Well, has the party kind of calcified in some respects and maybe aged out?
I think there is a bit of that. I think that's a good insight that there's some aging out, but there's also some people will not put up with not working hard. Dan Lipinski has not worked hard, and the machine honestly isn't working that hard anymore. It's not working for the people, at least. So how about if we get the guy out that doesn't do anything, and then how about if we start breaking up the machine that impedes progress, frequently impedes progress?
You ostensibly would go in, if you were to win, in the minority party.
Possibly.
Understood.
Yeah.
As it stands now, if you look just...
Right.
What can a minority freshman member of Congress do?
Work really hard. Let's be honest. You don't get the royal treatment when you're a freshman. Let's be really honest about that. I would fight hard to get health care for all passed, and that means I would be a worker bee. I would just be a workhorse that worked on all the process and the details because I'm a former management consultant and small business person, so I'm really good at that. I have a background in health care, so I work hard on health care for all. I would also work hard on working families' rights. I am very determined to get $15 an hour through with expanding universal child care. as well as getting paid leave and benefits done.
We're speaking with Marie Newman, Democratic candidate for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Showcase studio by Marie Newman, Democratic candidate for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. That's the southwest side, southwest suburbs, and she is challenging Congressman Dan Lipinski in the March 20th primary. And Marie, I'm wondering, why hasn't anybody challenged Dan Lipinski before?
I get asked that a lot, and it's really simple. So for the last 14 years, in a district that's filled with working families, with small businesses and on jobs, in our district, more folks have two jobs than one job. Everybody's incredibly busy taking care of kids, families, relatives, neighbors. Nobody has time to shut down a business or not have a job for a year. That's just as simple. So he just skates through because nobody has time to take on. This is a huge boulder. Not only am I fighting the machine all day long every day, I'm pushing the boulder up the hill against the Lipinski monarchy. So taking this fight on is not an easy thing. And I was lucky enough that my husband said, yeah, I will take care of everything else in our world, including kids and everything else. You go do this because I think you can win. So it's been a case where in the district, I think they just haven't had someone that had the capacity to do it.
Tell me about your background.
Sure.
And what makes you qualified for
right.
this.
So I started out in the marketing and advertising business, and I worked my way up to partner, was in executive management in a couple of smaller firms, started my own firm about 13 years ago. During that time, we had some right turns and left turns as a family. As a result of my son being bullied, I started at a national nonprofit, wrote a book, was a national advocate for bullying. From there, I worked on cancer clinical trials. I've also been the spokesperson for Moms Demand Action Illinois and worked on legislative policy at the national, local, and municipal level. Also have been an advocate for Lurie Children's Hospital. So really, I have a very blended background. I have a nonprofit background. I've run a national nonprofit program, business background, and I've lived in the district. I was born in Beverly, grew up in Palos, and I now live in Grange. So I know the district very well, and my personal experiences allow me to understand how we can practically and pragmatically develop legislation that actually works and gets results.
I would think a business background, a small business background, would be somewhat helpful to anybody running in politics, regardless mm-hmm. of party, just because of the crucial aspect that small
right.
businesses play in the economy.
Right. It's interesting. In my district alone, 80% of the small businesses are small businesses under $1.5 million in net revenue run by working families. So small business is actually very appropriate in the leadership of this district because I really understand it. So you need to understand process, people, talent, organization, product, service, and marketing. And I've done all of that. So it is really important.
Agendas.
Mm-hmm.
What are your priorities?
My priorities are to get health care for all. Through I'm a fan of Medicare for all, although I think on the process side we can do a lot better rolling this out. While I was a fan of Obamacare and it did a lot of great things, there were some process issues that were dramatic that could have been avoided. So with
all
that,
there's small business issues.
Yeah, exactly. Small business is one of them, and looking at the economy relative to the people that are receiving it. So I want to get Medicare for all through, help get it through. Want to get $15. Through, want to get a Clean DACA Act through, universal child care, and then bringing jobs to the district. One of my biggest efforts, and I've been working with community leaders already on this, is to take the Midway area and build a training and retraining center that would take all of these folks that have lost their jobs through automation or overseas issues and would retrain them in middle skills jobs. The last thing I would say is that right now we have a million construction jobs that are not filled right now, and it's because we don't have enough skilled labor in terms of electricians and carpenters and plumbers and construction management folks. So in that training center, I envision to go into the area in the Midway area. I would say that that is a perfect area to bring all of that talent back that we already have in the district and get them moving and building job systems.
And how do we do that, though? How do we bring that center there?
Yeah.
Where is the funding? Who runs it?
What? Well, I think, if I'm being very honest, that is one of the things that I'm going to do in every program is bring state, county, and federal together, convene meetings. Mr. Lipinski has never convened a meeting against those three levels of government. We have to start all working together, get the funding through, and then develop this program, because it will pay back. It will pay back in many ways, because then there will be taxes back into the system, whether it is a business or individual taxes. So it will pay itself back, but we do have to get those three groups together to make it happen.
How much of the dysfunction of Illinois government affects that third district and the people there and just the frustrations with how Illinois doesn't seem to be able to move forward.
So every meeting I have, and I've met with 5,000 people, every single meeting they're sick of the machine and they're sick of the state shenanigans. So let's take the people out that are responsible for that. Let's get rid of the Lipinski machine and let's ask Speaker Madigan to move along.
You think it's time for him to go?
I do.
Because of his ties with Lipinski, or just
because, and he may have done great things in his career, earlier in his career. Right now, he is supporting, they call it the incumbent protection program, that protects and keeps Lipinski in place when he knows he's a very weak leader. And he sends people out in droves to protect this guy when he does nothing and he's not effective. So that's egregious to me.
How familiar are you with the members of the delegation?
Obviously, I'm very, very familiar with Congresswoman Schakowsky and Congressman Gutierrez. They both have endorsed me.
And like Sherry Bustos?
I've met with Sherry, sure. Yeah. I've met with all, I mean, I've basically met with all of them, but two members are endorsing me.
And is this a delegation that you can work with? Because, I mean, even though we're seeing these strains, but there's things like on infrastructure, those kinds of things, that's normally a united delegation block on those things.
We are. I mean, Lipinski has turned his back on the delegation literally hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. So the delegation, while only two of them are endorsing me, I can't imagine the rest of them won't be happy if Mr. Lipinski moves along.
Well, that's Marie Newman. She's Democratic candidate for Congress. Marie, if people want to learn more about your campaign,
they should go to marienewmanforcongress.com or come and stop by at 5444 South Archer. marienewmanforcongress.com. Thank you so much.
Marie, thank you.